You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. There's an observation made by the French writer Simone de Beauvoir that women, by definition, are married or have been or plan to be or suffer from not being. And according to our next guest, marriage used to be the end of the story for women over the years, an end kind of to the narrative arc.
But these days, only 20% of Americans are married by the age of 29, compared to about 60% in 1960. In her new book, All the Single Ladies, Rebecca Traister looks at the influence of unmarried life on women's options, on society as a whole, and on what happens now that marriage isn't always a given for a new generation.
Rebecca Traister joins us now. She has written for Elle, The New York Times, and The Washington Post, and her new book is called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that it used to be that marriage was kind of the end of the story for women. You looked at literature, Anne of Green Gables, Laura Ingalls Wilder, Jo from Little Women. What did their stories say about the role of marriage?
Well, interestingly, their stories were ones where marriage was both the end of the story and it was necessarily the beginning of female adulthood. So I kick off the book by looking at my childhood heroines. So yes, Laura and Mary and Jo March and Shirley Jane Eyre. And those stories, those books were coming of age books, Buildings Roman. And interestingly, for women in previous generations, girlhood, when they were in moments where they were able to get educations, where they had hopes and friends and a degree of freedom, even in their youth, that's where their stories were told, where they got into trouble and scrapes and were badly behaved and had adventures. And that's what we read about in those coming-of-age tales. And then they all concluded with marriage. And we know it's the same, for example, for Disney movies and for many of Shakespeare's comedies, that they end with marriage. The happy ending is so often marriage. But for women in particular, and especially for those kinds of heroines, it's interesting because it meant adulthood. And that's because for so long in history, marriage and marriage to men who could be earners, who could make money, who could have financial security. Marriage was a necessity for women who didn't have that same kind of opportunity to be economically independent on their own or to have autonomous sex lives or to have children outside of marriage. So to be an adult woman for a lot of our history meant having to be a wife in order to have some of those kinds of stability and socially sanctioned freedoms. The beginning of adulthood was often kicked off by marriage, and then for women often defined by marriage. And so that was the end of the coming of age tales of my young heroine and the beginning of adulthood for a lot of women.
And for women, that age where marriage, where you got married was pretty young. It used to be between, 20, 22 years old. So there wasn't a whole lot of life lived on one's own before then.
Well, as I said, it was pretty difficult to live life on one's own if you were a woman. If the opportunity for education and for earning wages was limited, I mean, we still live in a world where women's pay equity isn't protected or guaranteed or mandated by the government. We know that women's fields tend to pay less than male-dominated fields, even today. And of course, those circumstances were so much worse just a few decades ago. There wasn't as much ability to live outside of marriage for so long. And so, yes, by necessity, once you were out of, for so many women, dependence on a man was necessary. So once you were out of your father's house as a child, there was a necessity. You sort of had to be attached to a man of some sort in order to have economic stability. So even women who weren't married in earlier eras were often dependent on brothers or brothers-in-law or still living with fathers, the kind of people who could earn money and secure some kind of stability for women. And so, yes, the marriage age for more than for 100 years that they counted, the median age of first marriage for women was just between 20 and 22. That was about average. It was the start of adulthood. But today it's over 27 nationally, and it's higher than that in many cities.
So, Rebecca, when did that start to turn around? Because it has been a radical shift, not just in the age that people get married, but in the choice whether to get married at all.
Right. Well, it really started to shift in mass numbers in the 1990s. There have been other eras that I write about in my book, including the 19th century, when gender ratios shifted. For example, all the men moved west. in the 19th century, and there were a lot of women on the East Coast who didn't marry at all because there weren't husbands. But then there were all kinds of pressures applied, and marriage became reestablished in the 20th century, early marriage, as the norm for women. And so the contemporary wave of singlehood for women really kicked off in mass numbers in the 1990s. It was 1990 where that median age of first marriage that had remained between 20 and 22 for so long, for a century or more, jumped to over 23, which was a big shift. And it was in the 90s that we saw what sociologists call the great crossover, where the average age of first marriage actually went higher than the average age of first birth. So you saw an increase in women having children outside of marriage. And that was all happening in the early 90s.
So I guess the question is, what happened in the 90s to make that shift possible?
Well, a lot of things. A lot of very consciously political movements of the mid-20th century, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the sexual revolution, the gay rights movement, all those things had this profound impact on the conditions for women. So, for example, the ability to better control reproduction through legalized access to contraception and through legalized abortion. The more women flooding into workplaces, Title IX, that meant that more women could experience higher education, could go into colleges, could compete in colleges, could compete in the workforce. You know, things like the Equal Credit Opportunity Act in 1974 that gave women something greater to equal opportunity economically. Those things created conditions for women to be able to live outside of marriage. It also did something. They also did something. Those revolutions of the 1970s led to a big spike in divorce rates for traditionally married hetero couples. And those divorce rates really spiked in the late 70s and the 80s. And so you had a generation of people coming in the 90s who had the opportunity to live. Women could do other things with their lives besides get married. They could have careers, they could earn money, they could have a liberated sex life. And so they didn't have to get married. And also many of them had reckoned with the dissolution of their own parents' marriages and saw marriage as an institution of variable quality, not something they had to do, but something that if they did, they wanted to make sure it was good and stable. And that often takes longer to find.
We're talking to Rebecca Traister right now. She's the author of the new book called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation. And you spoke with a lot of feminists to write this book, and it sounded like the second wave feminists were kind of saying, oh, you didn't just invent all these options in the 90s. We get some credit for this. Who does get the credit in terms of the feminists?
Well, the story of women moving closer to independence is a story that, as I learned as I was writing the book and as I describe in the book, is a history that's woven throughout all of American history. So there's not, you can't give, if you want to start giving credit, we should go back to Susan B. Anthony, who gave a speech in 1877, who said, you know, about the homes of single women. Or even before that, there were women writing at the Revolution about the connection between personal liberty and the kind of fight, you know, the young United States was having over its notion of equality and representation versus the impositions of the marital contract. So the credit extends way beyond. But it is true that lots of women in the 1970s who were part of the women's movement objected to marriage and said it was called it a patriarchal institution, and that there were numbers of women who abstained from it or delayed it to prioritize their career or their educations. But that was a politicized choice in many cases, and it wasn't made in the mass numbers that are happening today. What's interesting about the women who are delaying or abstaining from marriage today is that they're not necessarily doing it out of any kind of self-conscious political action. They're not even necessarily making an active choice of rejecting marriage. They're simply living in a new way. This radical idea of disestablishing marriage as the central organizing force of women's lives has now been adopted as a mass behavior, where it's not that you're saying, oh, I reject marriage because it's a patriarchal institution, or I don't believe in marriage, or you know, you don't have to get married if you don't meet a person whom you want to marry. And that is radical. It's radical, but it's not a self-conscious political movement.
And you point out that single women today, I mean, it's not a one-dimensional story. Single women today are still more likely to live in poverty than men. They earn less than men on the dollar. So is single life for women harder than it is for men?
Well, it is. But I argue in the book that it's harder in large part because we still don't have social and economic policies in place to support women living independently. Our country, its civic institutions and its laws and its tax benefits and its housing benefits, and has been set up with the assumption that Americans live in early married hetero units. And so you see men, and especially white men in this country, enjoy a series of tax breaks and historically have enjoyed housing subsidies, and infrastructure has helped their businesses, all these kinds of benefits that have accrued to white men. And it was assumed that women were their mates and doing the kind of domestic work, taking care of the children, having children, and were at home and were not earners. We're not living that way anymore. But we don't have policies in place that acknowledge women as being equal earners in the public space. So we don't have things like paid leave, because the government is still assuming that when women have children, they're at home, not in a workplace. So we don't have paid leave. We don't have paid sick days, because we assume that there's a class of Americans who are going to just be at home when a kid is sick or when an aged parent is sick and someone needs to care for them. We assume we have a class of unpaid caretakers, wives. But we don't anymore. We have school days that let out at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and have long spring breaks. Many of us probably have kids who are on spring break right now. The assumption, who's going to take care of those kids? The assumption is there's a kind of American there to take care of those kids. That's not the way Americans are living right now. And so it is absolutely true that it is economically challenging for women to live unmarried. But it's not necessarily the fact that they're unmarried. It's the fact that we don't have policies that assume that women are independent and equal entities in the public, professional, and economic sphere.
Rebecca Traister is with us right now. She's the author of the new book, All the Single Ladies. We're tracing the history of unmarried women in the United States.
And we want to hear from you. What do you have to say? How has not getting married affected your life? Do you think society is more accepting of women who are single by choice? If you are married, how did that decision affect the storyline of your life? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking now with Rebecca Traister. She's the author of the new book, All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women and the Rise of an Independent Nation.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How has not getting married affected your life? Do you think it's more acceptable to decide not to get married today? Are there good role models today for single women with fulfilled, productive lives, maybe on TV or in books? Call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Rebecca, you write that single women over the years have used their time without marriage to change the social politics in the country, to affect a real lasting change in the country. How have single women influenced that course of history?
Well, the best example of that is from the 19th century, when all those men moved west, and so many of them were also killed during the Civil War, and there was a real husband shortage on the East Coast, especially for middle-class white women. Black women, marriage had not been legally recognized for enslaved people before emancipation, and then after emancipation, black marriage rates went way up because there was marital liberty. But for middle-class white women, they didn't marry as much in the middle to the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. And so there was a whole bunch of women for whom their lives were no longer taken over by wifely responsibility and maternal obligation. And instead, they turned their energies toward social reform movements, including abolition, suffrage, temperance, the labor movement. It was young, unmarried women working in factories and mills at the end of the 19th and beginning of 20th century who staged some of the first walkout strikes that led to the labor movement. It was women who founded so many colleges and settlement houses. Teaching became a profession that was conceived of expressly for unmarried women. And of course, this sort of culminated with the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1919 and its ratification in 1920. After that, there was some pressure put on women to go back into early married patterns. But the end of that 19th century was a real moment in which unmarried women powered so many disruptive social movements.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Joan on the line with us in Milwaukee. Joan, hi.
Hi. I'd just like to ask if in your book you've given any recognition to the Catholic sisters who went out west when it was still pretty wild, mm-hmm. and came all over the country and founded schools and hospitals and orphanages.
Joan, thanks. Rebecca, what about that?
I didn't write specifically about the Catholic Sisters moving west, but it is pretty fascinating that historically there were so few off-ramps from the highway to marriage to a man. And Catholicism, the church, really offered for centuries before it was increasingly possible for women to remain unmarried. Turning to the convent was one of the only other possibilities for women. And so there is this tremendous and pretty radical history of nuns and the church and this other religious path that women were more able to take than they were to take simply an unmarried but secular path. So there is a tremendous history that I do touch on in the book of the role that the church has played for women as a kind of alternate option to marriage and one of the only alternate options.
Well, thank you for the question, Joan. And we're going to take a comment here, a question from Julie. She couldn't stay on the line. And she said, what about the role of lesbians and non-hetero women who have suffered because men have typically been seen as the breadwinners?
Well, the fascinating history of the move toward gay marriage and marriage equality, lots of people cast that as a sort of retro reinscription of this traditional institution, marriage, on people who have lived outside of traditional norms and sort of a move toward backward. But in fact, I see this, the move toward gay marriage and the legalization of gay marriage as working hand in hand with a hetero move away from marriage as the only central organizing force of women's lives, precisely because it makes marriage mean something different instead of an organizing structure for power that's divided between men and women. It becomes a different kind of connection between people and a different kind of set of emotional commitments. And so it's helping to redefine marriage. And of course, as we have more women living independently of it on their own, in same-sex relationships, in same-sex marriages, what you're seeing is an expansion of opportunities, including economic opportunities for women, including those in same-sex partnerships where, yes, historically, if there wasn't a man involved, there was much more economic insecurity.
We're talking with Rebecca Traister right now, talking about the history of unmarried women in the United States. And Rebecca, is being a single woman later in life socially acceptable at this point, do you think, or seen as desirable? I know some journalists are writing about prejudice against single people as a group and also against older women, especially who are unmarried.
Well, it certainly gets harder and harder as you get older. Again, we don't have all kinds of policies that support extended life independent from marriage for women. And because many people do eventually marry, even though they're doing it at different points in life. So many of the women I spoke to did acknowledge that it becomes lonelier, the pressures applied become more intense as you get older and as more of your peers marry. But there are so many women who are, I mean, this is changing around us all the time. So I think the experience of someone today who is in her 30s, who may be single into her 50s or 60s, might be different from a person who's currently in their 50s and 60s and single. But yes, there's no question there is still stigma. And Bella DiPaolo, who's written about sort of structural prejudice against single people, you know, what happens when you don't get the tax breaks, when you are subject to additional costs, like you always have to have a double hotel room, even if you're just one person sleeping in it. There are all kinds of ways in which the world is set up for married people that makes it a challenging place for people living singly. However, the numbers are growing so swiftly that I think we're seeing alterations in how we live. One of the challenges for people growing old outside of marriage, you know, has been issues of care and companionship. Increasingly, we're seeing people live communally, if not maritally, then with friends or peers with shared living spaces. You know, we are shifting to adjust to the new ways in which we're living. And so it is my hope that it will become easier for people who remain single deeper into their lives.
And Rebecca, we've only got about 20 seconds left here, but what do you consider to be the next frontier of this movement?
I think we need to see social policy shifts. And I hope we see them coming with the next election. Things like a raising of the minimum wage, paid parental leave, paid sick days, subsidized early childhood education, the kinds of policies that will better support adult female independence.
Thank you so much for joining us, Rebecca.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Traister has written for Elle, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, and she's the author of the new book called All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation.